Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We often have guests on the show from think tanks, and we try to label them by their basic orientation for transparency. Liberal or conservative think tanks, or union-based, or hawkish foreign policy think tank, or whatever. Well, this week, the New York Times published a two-part investigative report alleging undue influence of corporate money in many think tanks, including very prestigious ones like the Brookings Institution and the Atlantic Council. Here with me to try to get objective about the findings is Eric Lipton, investigative reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Times, and Brooke Williams, contributor at the Times and reporter at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. Brooke and Eric, thanks for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
What were you looking for here, and what made you look in the first place, Brooke?
We were looking to see how think tanks interact with corporate donors. And this started a while ago, how we came to look in the first place. Eric, I'll let you
pick it up.
I'm sorry. Yeah, this dates back really to 2013, believe it or not. It's been it's a project that was conceived, 3 years ago, and it's been quite a long undertaking and a process of looking at think tanks in foreign countries as donors, think tanks and corporations as donors, and then the role that think tank scholars who are also have outside gigs as either lobbyists or consultants. And so we sort of walked across the spectrum.
And
we wanted to take it from the anecdotal, everyone knows this is happening, into the systemic, really looking at it with a wide lens. How often is this happening? How much?
And I'll bet some of you listening right now have questions about think tanks. You hear the term so often, guests here and elsewhere in the media referred to as from this or that think tank. And if you've ever worried or wondered about where think tanks' funding comes from and how that biases the conclusions that their thinkers might come to or anything else you want to ask about, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And you're right, for example, to get to the heart of the matter here, that the likely conclusions of some think tank reports, documents show, are discussed with donors or potential donors before the research is complete. Drafts of the studies have been shared with donors whose opinions have helped shape final reports. Donors have outlined how the resulting scholarship will be used as part of a broader lobbying effort. So, Eric, what is the relationship, and how broad a brush do you want to paint with here with respect to how much think tanks are just tools of individuals or corporations or industries with lobbying interests?
I mean, as we say in the first story that ran a couple of days ago now, you look at the bulk of the reports that come out from think tanks, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to identify any specific kind of clear alignment between the corporate donor and the content of the report. But that said, as you kind of look through the menu of stuff that's posted on most of these websites, and if you kind of could find out who actually funded them, as we did in many cases, you do see in many cases, although not a majority, you see this correlation between the donor's interest and the conclusions of the report. The think tanks argue that this is simply an alignment of common interest with common goals for societal good, and that the donor is supporting the research on a topic that they, like the health of American cities. But the thing that really changed it for us was internal documents that showed that when they were discussing these donations or soliciting more donations at Brookings in particular, they're giving assurances to the donors about how they were going to help their interests. They were making, that they were going to help the corporate interests of these donors at the same time as they were doing scholarship. And that presented a kind of a fee-for-service arrangement that seemed inappropriate in an organization that's a charitable organization that's So that's what we really were focusing on.
And Brookings has one of the best and most independent reputations, I think. It's kind of liberal-leaning, but not really dogmatic. And so it's kind of disillusioning to hear something like this goes on at Brookings. But tell me the specific story. Describe for our listeners the relationship with Kofi Bonner that you write about, the executive in charge of a prominent San Francisco development who came a Brookings senior, who became a Brookings senior fellow just as Brookings was looking for $100,000 in money from Bonner's company.
Well, there was a development in San Francisco, and Kofi Bonner was in charge of this development, Hunter's Point. And it had a PR issue. There was toxic waste on the land, and there was a lot of community opposition to this project. At the same time this was happening and they were trying to get approval of this project, they started donating to Brookings. And Brookings, in some of these internal documents, said that they would, you know, quote, engage with national media to develop stories that highlight Lennar's innovative approach. They also named Kofi Bonner a senior fellow at Brookings, and he used that position to advance Lennar's efforts. They called him a trusted advisor, and this is all in documents in which they're discussing how to solicit more donations from Lennar.
Let's take a phone call. John in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to get some clarification as far as the distinction between a lobbying firm and a think tank. Is a think tank, it seems like it's an incubator for certain familiar ways of thinking that are then become lobbyists. And also, I would also refrain from using words like prestigious and all of those highfalutin words when you're discussing these people, because to the majority of us, there's no prestige in what they do, actually.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that this series got started, in fact, is that there were a number of, to me at least, as my role, the New York Times' participation in it, was that a lobbyist, I had lunch with a lobbyist one day who was going on and on about how frustrated he was that he has to file under law a disclosure with this House and the Senate to indicate who his clients are, how much he's paid, which branches of the government he's intervening with, and what bills in Congress that he's working on. But that he then helps clients make donations to major think tanks. And then the think tank writes the report at the urging of the corporation that he's representing, and then goes and contacts members of Congress and the administration, making the argument that the company wants, and passes out the report. And they walk away, and they're not sort of tarred with the description of the name lobbyist, because they're not required to register as lobbyists, even though they've been paid by the corporation to help it move its agenda, and then they execute on that. And so it's hard, in fact, to distinguish between the role that the lobbyist is playing and the role that the think tank is playing, even though, you know, they're doing similar things, but they have completely different sets of rules. And that's part of what we're examining here. And again, the think tanks argue that they have common interests and that they're not lobbying on behalf of the donor. But when you look at what the donor wanted them to do and what they did, it's the same. So it seems like there may be a problem.
You were told that, quote, executives at Brookings, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and other think tanks say they have systems in place to ensure that their reports are based on scholars and independent, on the independent conclusions of their scholars. Brooke, were you able to verify that any of those systems are in place, those kinds of intellectual firewalls, or that they're not?
The institutions, many of them do have systems in place. Now, how those systems work is not something that we were able to identify in many cases. Going back a few years ago, we read Brookings' internal documents explaining what rules scholars would have to follow in terms of outside positions and other things. So there are systems in place. Now, how they are executed within these institutions, we don't know.
Now, Brookings did issue a rebuttal to your article about it. It says, cherry-picked phrases lifted from thousands of pages of internal, often informal or draft documents, using them out of context. They also ignore a large body of evidence we made available to them, demonstrating that the projects in question were developed in ways that hewed to our institutional standards of scholarly independence. Eric, how do you respond to Brookings' allegations against your report being misleading?
I think that Brookings' position is that they maintain the intellectual independence of the scholarship that they produce, that they are the only ones that can determine the conclusions. Let's look, for example, at KKR, the private equity investment firm, which is a major donor to Brookings. So KKR starts up an infrastructure and real estate fund of a couple billion dollars and then begins to accelerate its donations to Brookings around 2010. And then Ken Melman, one of the executives at KKR, a former Washington official as well, suggests, why don't we co-write a paper that talks about public-private partnerships, which are investment vehicles that that firms put money into and then do infrastructure projects, like a water treatment plant in Bayonne, New Jersey. And so Brookings agrees to co-author this report with KKR. The report is then put on KKR's website, which specifically features KKR's project. And so, Brookings at that point has become part of a public relations project for KKR, because now KKR is promoting its, using its funds to do more public-private venture projects, and with the imprimatur of Brookings and the stamp of approval. And that benefits KKR's bottom line. It's a for-profit company. It's made a donation to Brookings. I just think that raises questions about how independent is that work. Even if Brookings says that they really can stand by it, are they being influenced by the money that led them to write that? If they're in their internal documents, it shows that it was Ken Melman in the process of the solicitation of the donations that suggested that they do that report together.
Eric Lipton and Brooke Williams with us on their New York Times series that's investigating the financial ties of think tanks and how that might bias their scholarship and bring them closer to what we would think of as a lobbyist than an independent scholarly institution. Henry in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Henry.
Hi, guys. Good morning. My question was that, so if you have a scholar that has point of view that happens to align with the company's point of view, and so why is it ethically wrong for the company to sort of sponsor and propagate that point of view if it already exists, right? The companies like Verizon you talked about this morning wasn't directing the sort of course of the studies, but was just knew about the fact that scholars support them and are financially supporting them. So if a scholar has a point of view, why not make money off having that point of view?
Who wants it?
I mean, that argument has been made to us, and he's sort of referencing Jeffrey Eisenach, who's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, who has done an enormous amount of consulting work with the telecommunications industry through a private firm that he works at. At the same time, he's a visiting scholar at AEI, and he was one of the leading players through his status as a think tank scholar in opposing the net neutrality regulations. So here's a guy who's testifying before the Senate, who's intervening in emails and in personal meetings with members of the FCC and their staffs and arguing against the net neutrality regulations at the same time as he's being paid by major telecommunications companies that for the most part oppose net neutrality. And so he argues, and this gentleman is arguing, that that's not a conflict of interest because Jeffrey Eisenach really believes that net neutrality is a bad thing. But how do you separate? How can you separate the fact that the guy is on the side in his wearing his hat as a consultant, is being paid by these companies who have billions of dollars at stake in this debate, and then on the other side he's a think tank scholar who's with the white hat and pontificating as if he's sort of an independent voice and testifying before Congress.
Right.
That's a conflict of interest.
And your article refers to a letter that FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler received about net neutrality that I think you characterize as misleading. Is it misleading in the sense that it doesn't disclose the full spectrum of the financial relationship between the thinker and his content?
Yeah, in that situation, he writes a letter to the incoming chairman of the FCC and in his from his position as an AEI scholar. And there's a bunch of studies cited in there. And it says that the people that are participating in that letter are not doing it on behalf of any industry players. But in the letter, but if you were to go and actually look at the studies, you'd see that most of those studies, in fact, were paid for by the industry. And so these guys are, again, sort of wearing their hats as academics and think tank scholars and making their arguments, but they're being funded by the industry. So they have it. I mean, you have a natural bias. If your paycheck is coming from an industry sector, you know, no matter what you argue your beliefs are, it's being influenced by, you know, the source of those funds.
Another example you give is one of Center for Strategic and International Studies researchers writing a letter to Pentagon officials in support of allowing the sale of drones outside the United States after studies were in part funded by General Atomics, a California drone manufacturer. So that relationship obviously raises eyebrows. We're going to run out of time soon. Do you think there's a difference between liberal and conservative think tanks in this respect? If we start with the assumption, which may or may not be accurate, that liberal think tanks are less tied to corporate agendas, sometimes they're more likely to fight against corporate agendas. Is this any less true at, you know, whatever, the Economic Policy Institute, Center for American Progress, pick your liberal think tank or them as a sector?
From what I've examined, it's not any less true.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, these conflicts are on both the left and the right. They're pervasive in this world. I mean, again, it's not, you know, in many studies there are no conflicts, but there's enough of them out there that are troubling that I think, you sort of have to step back and think about this. This is something the think tank industry needs to think about more.
So what do you recommend? I mean, should a show like this one stop inviting people from think tanks, or at least anytime we have one, identify not only the philosophical or political orientation of the think tank, but ask the guest if there was any related funding for the study to the topic of the study, or I don't know what else.
One of the problems, which even the folks from Brookings acknowledged to us, is that so many corporations and foundations now donate money. Project-specific funds. It used to be that they would say, "We like the work you do. You know, you're helping society. Here's $1 million. You know, go do good research." So even if it were J.P. Morgan Chase giving that $1 million, you know, it was washed essentially by Brookings because they decided the topics that they thought were appropriate to do the research on. But the problem now is that foundations and corporations increasingly want to fund specific projects that match their corporate goals or their philanthropic goals. And then they get involved to an extent that makes this much more difficult. And even the think tanks themselves sort of yearn for the day when they had unrestricted grants from foundations and from corporations. And so it makes your job, you know, in terms of a host that's having think tanks, scholars, much harder, because so many of the projects they're talking about were funded by individuals or corporations or foundations that have a specific interest in the outcome. And it complicates these questions we're discussing.
All right. Something to be learned by us, something to be learned by government policymakers when they're informed by the studies that come out of think tanks, something to be learned by all of you as consumers of news and consumers of policy. And we thank Brooke Williams, contributor to The Times, Eric Lipton, Times investigative reporter in Washington, for their series on think tanks and for sharing some of it with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.